This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, December 30th. I'm your host, Dave Bettinger. Very glad to have you joining us today. This week, we'll revisit some of the stories and interviews we featured on this program over the past year, like that awesome milestone the Bristol Bay Fishery crossed last summer.
Any one of these fish that we pick could possibly be fish number 2 billion.
Plus, a conversation with one skipper on how the fishing went, a couple of wildlife stories that stood out to us, and one dramatic tale of rescue at sea.
I must have passed out or something because I heard a knock on the kayak, like somebody knocking on the door, you know? And when I woke up, the seal was like 2 feet away from me, like a guardian angel watching over.
Poetry and song, a visit to those walrus at Cape Gregg, and we drop into what must be the most unique prom on the planet.
These guys get all decked out, and it's a beautiful thing. This is one of my favorite nights here, because this is the only time that they have to be around people that are not from their schools.
It's an hour-long show, Bristol Bay and Beyond 2016, in case you missed it. We'll start our look back with an impressive and interesting milestone that this region passed in 2016. In July, we followed along as the 2 billionth commercially caught salmon was landed by someone, somewhere, in Bristol Bay, the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery that has a 132-year history. Our storyline started a little before the nets went out. It fell to Bob King, the longtime news director at KDLG and now avid fish historian, to announce this milestone in an essay he penned last fall.
Since the canned salmon industry came to Bristol Bay in 1884, fishermen have landed 1.99 billion salmon, 93% of which were sockeye. It took 95 years for Bristol Bay to produce its first billion salmon. The 2 billionth fish will come just 38 years after that.
King had been quietly watching the numbers for some time. After the Department of Fish and Game issued the forecast for the 2016 salmon run to Bristol Bay, he knew this would be the year. Fish and Game confirmed King's tally and decided that the 10,033,455th salmon harvested this season would mark 2 billion. As the run took shape, it was clear that salmon would be landed on Wednesday, July 6th, an appropriately cool, rainy day in Bristol Bay. At Dillingham's Kanakanak Beach, set netters were headed out that afternoon for an opener.
So the 2 billionth salmon's going to get caught today.
We caught it this morning, about 2 o'clock.
This is Coffee Point set netter Corey Evans with the common response. Evans also offered reflections shared by many about the fishery and the milestone.
It's impressive it's gone on for this long, and it's I think it says something about the management. That we can keep it going like this, that, you know, it's not, you see a lot of fisheries that have trouble and through the years, and this one seems to be going pretty strong, so it's really nice to see.
How'd that 2 billionth one look this morning?
Big.
Steve Becker is also a set netter who was getting ready to launch for that afternoon's opener.
The what?
The 2 billionth salmon.
Really?
In the fishery's commercial history.
In the history of,
gonna
really.
Caught today. Any thoughts?
I'm going to catch it.
How do you know it'll be you?
How does anybody know who it's going to be? It's going to be me.
Whoever catches the 2 billionth salmon next year will never be known. Fishing will probably be fast and furious when next year's catch tops 9.5 million. Anyone could claim credit for catching the 2 billionth salmon. And everyone should.
Kyle Blackham down on Coffee Point.
2 billionth fish is going to get caught somewhere in Bristol Bay today. Thoughts?
Yeah, we're going to catch that. Then we're going to mount it, frame it. Sell it on eBay. I don't know. We'll do something with it.
Maybe you'll get a better price than 50 cents a pound for it.
Hopefully.
Well, good luck, and what do you think that says about the bay?
Well, it's an ecological wonder. I mean, it's a magnificent display of, you know, the bounty of raw nature.
On Wednesday, salmon were picked from gill nets in Ugashik, Igigik, Naknek, Kwijak, Togiak, Igushik, and Nushigak. The milestone fish came from somewhere, anywhere in the bay. Matt Shawcroft and his four kids put their net in the water just after 2 p.m. Maybe they caught it.
Oh, Jason, Do you want to make me famous or what?
So we are picking the 2 billionth fish in Bristol Bay. Okay, today, any one of these fish that we pick could possibly be fish number 2 billion. So this is a special day in Bristol Bay. You guys ready to pick the net?
As they stretch their net from shore, a few hundred pounds of sockeye filled the meshes, and generations 2 and 3 of Shawcroft set netters began picking them out.
Okay, looks like Emma got fish 2 billion. You may have to be 2 billion and 1.
I didn't know that's fish 2 billion. What if I had? What if that was fish 999?
Sockeye came in the boat one after the next and were laid into the brailer bag's icy brine. The rain turned from a drizzle to a downpour. A perfect Bristol Bay July afternoon.
All right, James, so we hit 2 billion today. You picked out one of those. What are the odds you'll be here to pick the 3 billionth?
576 to 1.
You want to stick with this business long enough to be around to pick the 3 billionth in another 30 years?
I don't know.
But I bet you'd be glad to know that it will be there, right?
Yeah, I know it'll be there. But I don't know if I'm the one who's going to pick it.
I'll be the one who will pick it.
The 3 billionth may be a ways off, but not an unreachable goal for these young fishermen. Skipper Howard Knutson has been picking salmon from the bay's waters for the last billion plus. He also landed the milestone fish, pulled from near the mouth of the Ugashic River.
Well, it's just a great honor. It's a big surprise. And
Norm says you're the oldest guy fishing in the bay, the oldest permit holder anyway. Is that true?
That could be. I'm 86 years old.
86? Mm-hmm. So how long have you been fishing up here?
Well, in the bay, this is my 45th year.
You're not getting too old to keep coming out here, are you?
No, I don't think so.
One of Knutson's salmon got the VIP treatment, delivered straight to Governor Bill Walker's doorstep in Juneau a day later. BBEDC's Norm Van Vactor thought that'd be a nice gesture.
One of the issues I'm sure that the governor's dealing with is a lot of pros and cons and comments about the PFD. Well, we can speak to Alaska's other PFD, which is our Bristol Bay Salmon resource. And just like the financial PFD, this is also a resource that needs to be protected for generations and generations.
The milestone salmon could have been a pink, a coho, a chum, or a king. But in Bristol Bay, the overwhelming odds are that it was a sockeye. From the drift boat or set net skiff, it was sold to a tender or driven up a beach and ended up at a processor. Then it was canned, frozen, or flown out fresh. Icicle Samantha Russell showed off the 2 billionth fish after it had made its way into her plant late Wednesday evening.
So we're standing here on the sorting line at the Icicle Seafoods Wood River plant. And my name is Samantha, and I'm pleased to announce that I'm holding the 2 billionth sockeye salmon we harvested out of Bristol Bay.
Tell me about this guy in particular. That's a good-looking fish.
It sure is. That's about a 10-pound round fish here, 100% scales, firm, number one quality.
Where will this end up?
We're going to pack this fresh and fly it out on Alaska Airlines tomorrow, and this fish will wind up somewhere on the East Coast.
So the 2 billionth Bristol Bay salmon is going to be on somebody's dinner table this week?
It should be on somebody's dinner table probably by tomorrow evening.
With continued scientific management of the salmon resource, maintaining the fish's natural habitat, and a little good luck, Bristol Bay fishermen might look forward to catching its 3 billionth salmon in 2054.
By the time the 2016 season wraps up, this fishery will be another 25 or 30 million salmon closer to that next milestone. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, the In Case You Missed It year-end hour-long edition. I'm Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. We'll borrow this next interview from our sister program, the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. 2016 was a pretty good year for the fishery. The run size was more than ample. The price improved. There weren't any limits, and there was a lot of fishing time. When we wrapped up our coverage on July 22nd, we invited Skipper Robert Hyeno in to give us a word from the fleet side on how this season went.
Good to have you back in our studios, Robert. Initial reaction to 2016 so far. I know you're not done, but initial reaction to 2016.
Well, it's good to be here, Dave. Thanks for the invite. Actually, pretty happy with 2016. I think there's a lot of reasons why we should be happy. You know, no limits that I'm aware of this year, and the going home price is higher than last year, and strong run throughout all the districts in Bristol Bay, I guess. I don't really know what Togiak's doing, and the fleet, for the most part, was kind of evenly dispersed for the most part, except, you know, just the last week or two here, on they all kind of piled into the Nakni Kwijak, and I think that helped spreading the effort out for everybody.
It seems almost, it seems very unusual for so many things to be so decent. What's going on here? It's becoming a gentleman's fishery, or too easy of a game here, maybe.
I wouldn't call it that. I mean, I spent the summer in Inushigak, and we were fishing those two tides a day. Not much time in between closures and openers. It was a grind, and my daughter tells me we spent over a month on the boat fishing. She says that's a new record for us, so without a break. So, no, I think in Inushigak here anyway, you know, we had an early start and it just kept on going, and which is good. I think you're right. You know, the AVA processors were able to take care of it, and let's hope they put it in the right product form.
We don't want to leave the other districts out, but speaking of the Inushigak, I hear it's been kind of an unusual year finding where the fish are at. What did you think?
Oh, it is. I really can't remember a year where the basically the run came up on the east side, tight to the east side, and in the shallow water, you know, and virtually nothing in the channels. And you could tell the whole fleet basically was over there on the east side. And that's the first time I could remember anything like that happening. You know, usually you have fish over there, but you're going to also have fish in the channels. So the reasons for that, not a clue. But
a jet boat year, I keep hearing.
Definitely jet boat shallow draft. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Made a big difference.
For those that had it.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you about something else. You've kept a close eye, a firm hand on the way this fishery is regulated and managed over your career. I'm looking here at the numbers through Wednesday anyway. The preseason forecast is going to be met or beat, likely. The harvest is good. The escapements that were changed last year raised up a bit. The levels, they've all been met without too much overescapement. It looks like maybe one or two rivers might hit the top end. Seems like Fishing Game did their part this year. Do you see anything that needed to be fixed, tweaked, something for next year?
No, and you know, I just came in this morning, so I'm not privy to a lot of the information that's out there. But no, for the most part, you know, looking at how it was managed and escapement and harvest and whatnot, I think it was spot on, you know, and it looks like there's going to be a strong tail to the run, so which is helpful.
We look at these numbers, the last couple of years have been pretty big, 14, 15. This year we'll probably hit past 50 million, I think, if it keeps going here. Do you think these numbers will continue, or are we bound to see a few years slip back into those 20 or 30 million size total runs?
Oh, yeah, I'd almost bet on it. I mean, this is, you know, runs like this are nice, but I don't think this is the norm at all. You know, you look at the history of the bay and, you know, up and down, and you have your cycles. And I think it's a good reflection on how the fishery's managed. And, you know, I've said this before, is virtually the spawning habitat is unchanged. And I think that's a big plus.
Tell me about the timing. It was late last year. It was so-called late this year. Are we looking at something that's now the norm?
That's a good question. I think that's an answer question for the scientific people. Definitely something's changing, you know, and I don't know if this is going to be the new norm or what it is, but yeah.
Herring caught you off guard early, and this one came again late. Is there some lesson to be learned as a fisherman that you just have to be, can't book yourself too tight?
Well, you got to be ready, I guess.
75-cent base price. I think some folks might see their way close to a dollar with the chilling bonuses and postseason adjustments, perhaps, but at least 90 cents for many. What's your reaction to that?
Like everybody else, you know, I think coming off a 50 cents going home price last year, it's great. 75 and 15 is what, 90?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big plus. Big plus. You know, I think like everybody else, there isn't money in the for the fishermen at 50 cents a pound.
Right. And when we had these post-season conversations last year with fishermen, there was almost a pessimism that was near depression about the ability to invest into this fishery for the younger folks and such. Do you see a better picture, a better outlook?
Well, it's going to be interesting because you're right. You know, I know of people that elected not to come.
Yeah.
Because of the 50 cents last year and not knowing what it was going to be this year. And I think it was finding crew members was more difficult this year. There's a lot of people looking for crew members. You know, you, as a boat owner, if there's no money in it at 50 cents, definitely not for a crew member either.
What's on your mind? What's on your agenda heading into the off season?
I think most of my time is going to be spent on trying to look at additional protections for the uplands and the waters in those uplands to protect the spawning habitat and whatnot, because I think that's going to be the thing that's going to come around and bite us, especially with the state's current financial situation. We need to be real careful there.
All right. Robert, what else before we let you get back to the Lady Mindy?
Well, I just wanted to mention your fishery reports that you put on the radio. I found them very informative. And I really liked the mix of people that you had in, you know, from Warner Lou to Michael Link and all the other managers in between. I think you mixed them up real well. More so this year in the past because, you know, most of us have GCI cell service here. And this year, for whatever reason, you know, there was no signals. You couldn't get any emails or anything like that downloaded. So a lot of the information we were getting through that system was not available to us. So your reporting was extremely helpful for us to keep track of what's happening, not only in Bristol Bay, but appreciated your information on the ARM fishery also.
Well, I had to softball that interview to get to that nice compliment that you paid us there.
No, it's extremely important.
Well, we appreciate that. No, yeah, we appreciate that, and we always appreciate the feedback, but happy to have Robert Hiano in the studio again for the kind of the last word on the fisheries report from the fleet side. Thanks so much, Robert, and whatever is left this season, I hope you enjoy this next week or two.
Yeah, well, when we go back out, it'll be more a relaxing atmosphere. So, thank you.
Perfect for an elderly gentleman like yourself.
Thanks.
And now I think of my life as vintage wine from fine older kegs, from the brim to the dregs. It poured sweet and clear. It was a very good year.
In case you're just joining us, we're looking back at just a few of the stories we covered in 2016. It seems every year we hear of at least one really impressive survival story. Think of Ronald Johansson in 2015, clinging to a bundle of firewood in the Bering Sea off of Good News Bay, or Frank James and three others from Good News Bay drifting 180 miles on an iceberg in the spring of 2012. This year's happened in late April when a swamped kayaker survived hours in the frigid waters off the Alaska Peninsula. Hannah Colton reported the story.
Port Hyden Bay is partly sheltered from the ocean by a narrow strip of land that stretches north across the mouth. At the end of it is Stroganoff Point, about 5 miles across the water from the village. That's where 36-year-old Andrew Lind was headed on a Thursday afternoon.
Well, it is a beautiful, flat, calm day, and I wanted to go out kayaking out on the ocean, look at the wildlife.
Lind describes himself as a normal village guy. Originally from the Chignecks, he does subsistence, and he's a crew leader for the hazmat cleanup project at Port Hyden's old military site. Lind set out just after 1 p.m. and paddled to Stroganoff Point in his 8.5-foot plastic kayak. He took in the sights and then turned around.
halfway back. I texted my wife and told her I'm on my way back.
Lind sent that text at 3:37 p.m.
And by that time, the wind and the waves started picking up, and I got caught up in the main channel, and a white cap tipped me over.
Lind got himself out of the kayak and started trying to put it upright. But every time he tried to flip it, it would just scoop up more water and get more swamped.
So I couldn't do that, and then I just leaped the kayak upside down in order to the air pocket in the bow.
He wasn't wearing any flotation device, but he was able to keep his head out of the water by hanging onto the boat. Lind says pretty soon his arms just cramped around the kayak, holding him in place. Based on the time in the text message, Lind and his friends and family figure he was in the water somewhere between 1.5 and 3 hours. According to NOAA, the average water temperature there this time of year is just under 40 degrees.
It felt like I was in there forever, like nobody was going to come.
Somebody did come, even before the rescue crew, but it wasn't a human someone.
At one point, there was a seal. I must have passed out or something because I heard a knock on the kayak, like somebody knocking on the door, you know? And when I woke up, the seal was like 2 feet away from me, like a guardian angel watching over, keeping me awake.
Back in Port Hyden, Lind's wife, Miranda, realized he was overdue. Around 5:30, she started calling people to help. James Christensen is Lind's brother-in-law and a pilot who owns the only private plane in the village.
So we took off and we went out, checked the islands across the bay and couldn't find them. So we started searching between the bayside and the mainland. My daughter happened to see some movement in the water.
It was just 15 minutes after they took off that Christensen's daughter spotted Lind about 2 miles offshore. They began circling low and radioed to people in the village who were launching two skiffs. Bruce Bishop, a coworker of Lind's, drove one of the boats.
Ironically, we got the first skiff got almost to him. He was just in front of me, got almost to him, and ran out of gas. Somebody had taken the gas out of his skiff.
Luckily, Bishop's skiff did have a full tank, and he and two other men made it to Lind just after 7 p.m.
Oh, my God, he was just a horrible blue color. Boy, he was just not in good shape at all. And Andrew's a big boy. Andrew's probably, 260 or better, and it was everything that the three of us could do to drag him over the side of the boat.
The boat crew says Lind was conscious and coherent. Lind doesn't remember anything from when he was pulled from the water until he came to at the clinic. His core temperature had dropped to 92 degrees by the time health aides started warming him up with heated blankets. This is not your typical search and rescue story. The entire operation happened in less than 2 hours with no outside help from troopers or Coast Guard. And of course, there was plenty of luck involved. If Lind hadn't had cell service, if Jimmy Christensen had been flying elsewhere that day, so many things could have ruined this happy ending. But one thing that didn't seem like luck is the way people in Port Hyden knew how to spring into action. Bruce Bishop, the skiff driver, says that's not an accident. He and some of the other rescuers all work at the hazardous waste cleanup site, so they all have up-to-date first aid, CPR, and other training. But it's not just the training.
We work together every day, so we have good communication skills between us, and probably what made this all work, you know.
Andrew Lind says what kept him kicking was faith and his family.
There was lots of praying to God, talking to my family, and my kids and my wife, who would take care of them if something did happen. I think that's what pushed me to hold on.
He doesn't know what to make of the seal. Later, rescuers would find that seal stayed near the kayak until well after Andrew was safely out of the water. For KDLG, I'm Hannah Colton.
Another interesting story from the Alaska Peninsula this year made itself known about the same time last spring as that dramatic rescue. Thousands of Pacific walrus were spotted at a new haulout near Cape Gregg, just north of Pilot Point. In early summer, I headed down to take a look. Regular listeners have heard about the walrus at Cape Gregg more than just a few times now, and we don't want to overdo it, but thousands of them are still there, and they're kind of a big deal. A fishing boundary has been changed. The feds are getting involved in a successful state-managed fishery, and they're also perhaps the next big thing for Bristol Bay's bustling tourism industry. Last Sunday, Branch River Air Service out of King Salmon offered to take staff from the Gold Creek and King Salmon Lodges down to take a look to see if it's a trip their guests might be interested in. I happened to be in town, and my friend Matt Norman at King Salmon Lodge offered me his seat in the aircraft heading down the peninsula. Branch River Air Chief Pilot Brian Fender took us that way.
We're about 8 miles to the northwest of Pilot Point, and we're in a Beaver on Wheels. We just came over the beach, and I looked for the nicest, smoothest, longest stretch of beach into the wind, they kind of have a bit of a crosswind, and touched down there and taxied to within about a mile or so. And then we're going to walk over and get over on the bluff.
Before landing, we took a look at the old Ugashic North Line boundary and its proximity to the giant mass of blubber nearby. Fender came down to take a look by himself a few weeks ago, and I asked what stood out to him.
How prehistoric they look, and how they're even capable of moving on land at all.
Then there's that other thing about walrus haulouts.
If the wind is right, or I guess wrong, depending on how you look at it, they're quite pungent, yes.
The mile walk up along the coast is pleasant, the blubber taking shape into individual animals as you approach, and there's an easy spot to climb the bluff behind the walrus. When you peek back over the edge, below are hundreds, eventually probably close to 2,000 Pacific male walrus, mostly doing a whole lot of nothing.
What do you think?
It's a one-of-a-kind sight. Like that? Definitely not, but I don't mind.
It is pretty incredible smell.
What about the sight? What are you seeing down here?
They're just lounging. It's kind of fun. They're just lounging and sunbathing. It's pretty amazing, really.
Crawling over top of each other.
That was Catherine Ellis and Jack Moody from the Gold Creek Lodge. It proved a bit too windy Sunday to capture the sound of the walrus noises, which seem best described as huffin', snortin', rootin', and tootin'. A few dozen at a time filed off into the water to feed, their heads disappearing beneath the waves. But really, it's called a haulout for good reason. Hundreds of these up to 2-ton male layabouts were enviably carefree. It was a sunny day. Flippers flipped sand on warm bodies and oosics flapped in the breeze. Sandra Ducrosse from the King Salmon Lodge says she took note of the subtle differences these pinnipeds display.
Yeah, the longer you sat and watched, and we were sitting for maybe, an hour? Within the first few minutes, you could see personalities arise.
Lodges like hers that cater to tourists coming to Bristol Bay to see Katmai's bears and birds and catch a few kings might certainly enjoy a trip down the coast for this.
I think if you love nature, this is definitely something to see. I don't think you could sit there and not be in awe with what we just saw.
Most of the aircraft that ferry the bay's visitors each summer are on floats. If day trips to see the walrus at Cape Gregg is to become a thing, a taxi like Branch River Air Service would have to try landing on a nearby pond or to keep a plane on wheels. It's a 45-minute flight each way, but that's a lot closer than Cape Seniavin and considerably cheaper still than getting to Round Island. Our pilot, Brian Fender, has already heard of people asking to book trips down to see these unique animals in this very unique spot.
This isn't a zoo, and it's not even Brooks Camp. We're just on a beach on the bay side of nowhere, I guess.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment.
Hi, this is Tim Troll, host of Our Story, heard here on KDLG Weekly. You know, in the old days, storytelling was the chief form of entertainment. It was through storytelling that legends, history, and directions for living were passed on from one generation to another. Many times, these stories would be told in the Gazigik, the Kashim, the men's house, where people gathered to dance, have festivities, and to hear stories. Well, in many respects, KTLG is our modern Gazagik. And I'd like to ask you to help us keep this old drafty Gazagik on the air so that we can use it as a place to tell stories. Your modest, tax-deductible donation can go a long way to helping us preserve, through the airwaves of KDLG, the history and lore of Bristol Bay.
And we are trying to keep up the tradition of gathering and telling good stories over the airwaves and online here at KDLG. Over the past 2 years, we have invested more in our news department than ever before, adding more staff and traveling to more places to meet you where you are at. It's not been cheap, and it comes amidst steep cuts to our budget from state and federal grants. If you appreciate what we do and would like to see it continue, we do need your support, and soon. KDLG is always here, but it's not free. Please take a few minutes to call in a pledge or use our website to make a donation. Thank you. One of the locations we traveled to this year was New Halen, for one, to take a look at that incredible Tazimina Falls Hydro Station. Another reason was to drop in on the Lake and Peninsula School District prom. If you consider how small some of the district schools are, sometimes with just a handful of high schoolers, you can appreciate why they bring all the schools together for one big prom event. If there's another place in the world that puts so many small planes in the air and travels these distances for prom, we don't know of it. From Perryville to Port Allsworth, nearly 70 prom-goers from 9 schools met in New Halen Thursday, Thank you. Most helping all day to set up the new gym for the night's festivities.
What are you looking for at the moment?
We're looking for candles to put on the tables. Because right now all we have are just little lights strewn across the gym. We don't really have much lighting for people to see and eat.
That's Marcy Allsworth from Tenalian. Kate Cornell, a teacher at New Halen, is lending more than just a hand to put the final touches on the decorations as the teenagers start sneaking off.
It's about 3:30. They only have a couple hours before prom's going to start, so they're going to be wanting to scoot pretty soon and start taking showers and fixing their hair and getting their dresses on. These guys get all decked out, and it's a beautiful thing. This is one of my favorite nights here because this is the only time that they have to dress up and get fancy and actually be around people that are not from their schools.
Which begs the question in Lake and Penn, how does one find his or her date for the night?
With people asking each other, you get here, you kind of scope them out, and if you see something you like, you go for it. It's pretty cute, actually. And that's what's so lovely about this, though, is that once everybody's here, the dating pool gets so much bigger.
The large delegation from Port Allsworth's Tenalian School agrees to avoid that stress. Junior Anthony McGee tells me when I ask if he has a date.
I do not. Our school goes all together.
A couple of anxious-looking young men hustled into the gym, still carrying some of their attire in hand.
I don't know how to tie a tie.
They found Lake and Penn Superintendent Ty Mace, who knotted up a few quick Windsors.
Mr. Mace,
yes.
I think he ties ties better than you.
Tim?
Yeah.
It's all the same way.
It's really nice. And then yours
looks great.
But yeah, I could see my button.
Travel isn't cheap, and school districts like Lake and Penn are cutting their budget anywhere they can in light of reduced funding from the state. But prom, says Mace, is not something he expects to see on the chopping block.
This is one of those events that we've never considered cutting. It's kind of the culmination of our school year. The kids look forward to it. It's the money spent is well worth it.
Teachers sold roses at the door, middle schoolers served dinner inside, and photographer Dan Bandel set up a studio to capture memories on behalf of families 100 miles away.
The dream of every photographer is to have a Pulitzer Prize winning photograph, but you know, my photographs are hanging on refrigerator galleries and aunties and uncles and grandparents all up and down the Southwest Alaska. So
it did take a while to sort of break the ice, make that transition from the dinner tables to the dance floor, and Allie Smith gave a handful of boys a quick earful.
I was telling them that they shouldn't judge if they're not going to dance. See, the girls are just dancing with themselves because nobody's going to ask them. It's because they're shy.
Group songs are always good icebreakers, and that proved the case at the Lake and Penn prom, too.
Everybody clap your hands.
With a red rose in hand, one young man was holding fast to the sidelines, nervous look on his face, eyes focused on someone special a few tables away.
You gonna make a move?
Sure, yeah.
What are you waiting for?
For more people to go onto the floor.
Maybe they're waiting for you to start it. What are you looking at out there?
It's classified.
It didn't take too long for the action to pick up a bit, but before the sun set on that nice spring evening, Gregory Zakhar, a New Haven senior, was ready to swap his shirt and tie for camouflage. When it comes to the birds and the bees, he told me he had something different in mind.
Yeah, I want to go shoot ducks. It's more fun than this, I guess.
Really?
Yeah.
Now you're not giving up on asking these girls to dance, are you?
Oh, I already have a girlfriend, so I'd rather go shoot ducks. Yeah, I'd rather go shoot ducks.
In Bush, Alaska, that's hard logic to argue with, but it wasn't shared by all, including these girls who were enjoying every minute of Lake and Penn's Prom 2016.
Because I get to see your friends from different villages.
And there's more people. More people.
For KDLG's Bristol Bay and Beyond, I'm Dave Benninger.
Other's hearts, remember when.
We are looking back at 2016 this week in a special hour-long show. Thanks for staying with us. Regular listeners will know this program is KDLG's home for music, essays, and poetry. Like this poem, a 14-year-old Alexandria Ivanov from Unalakleet sent us after it won a statewide creative contest this spring.
Where Am I From? By Alexandria Ivanov. I am from scrumptious sourdough pancakes cooking in the morning haze, from Folger's coffee brewing and the birds chirping in the break of dawn. I am from the small red cabin miles up the river, the security of knowing I could just be. I am from the sweet-smelling bluebells, the evergreen pines whose long-gone limbs I remember as if they were my own. I am from tree-climbing and net-checking, from Aiden to Anne, from Papa Paul to Alan and Beth to B-Bucks. I am from joking and stubborn and creativity and will. I am from Let's Go and I Love You. I'm from Giving Away Your First Catch. I am from Alaska and Inupiaq family. From dry fish and strips, from getting caught in the net like my little brother, and their cautiousness ever since. The old wood stove and guns never to fire again. The memories here will never be forgotten.
Alexandria Ivanov from Unalakleet. Another young teenager from our listening area inspired us with his performance at the annual Poetry Out Loud competition in Juneau last spring.
My name is Sam Blom. I'm a junior, and I go to school at Tenalian in Port Ellsworth.
Now, to see Blom and the others, for that matter, perform these poems on stage, you'd think they've been gearing up for this competition since kindergarten, but he told me that's not the case.
Oh, I had no idea what Poetry Out Loud was a couple months ago, but my teacher, Mrs. Metzger, made my whole class memorize a poem and recite it, and I was chosen as the best in the school, so the video was sent on to the regional competition, and someone there decided they liked it, so I got an email one day saying I went to state.
So down to Juneau he traveled this week with three poems to recite in front of a warm and eager audience.
Our first competitor this evening is named Sam Blum, and he is representing Tenalian School in Port Ellsworth. Sam Blum is a junior, and he lives in Port Ellsworth, a small town of 200 people in southwestern Alaska. Ladies and gentlemen, please give me a round of applause for Sam Blum.
Say Not, the Struggle Not Availeth, by Arthur Hugh Clough.
I had to have a poem written before the 20th century, and that fit the bill, but I really liked the way it sounded and what it was about, just saying not to give up. There's a lot more that's going on than you know about.
Say not, the struggle not availeth. The labor and the wounds are vain. The enemy faints not nor faileth, and as things have been, they remain. If hopes were dupes, fears may be liars. It may be, and yon smoke concealed, your comrades chase even now the flyers. and, but for you, possess the field. For while the tired waves vainly breaking seem here no painful inch to gain, far back through creeks and inlets making comes silent, flooding in the main. And not by eastern windows only, when daylight comes, comes in the light. In front the sun climbs slow, how slowly, but westward, look, the land is bright.
Again, that was Sam Blom. I asked him about the age-old fear of getting up on stage in front of people and hoping words do tumble forth from one's mouth.
Well, public speaking, I like public speaking a lot. It's always nerve-wracking before I get on stage, but once I get up there, I usually figure out I have a lot to say, and that's how I felt. I wanted to say what the poems meant to me and be able to share that with whoever was watching. And it was a little nerve-wracking being on TV. It was a different experience, and I enjoyed it a lot.
After I spoke with Blom yesterday, something about the way he had answered didn't sit right with him, and he called me back to say that he wanted to clarify a little bit about his gifts and abilities, which an honest observer would admit are many.
I really can't take any credit for anything, any success that I have or anything like that, because really the only reason that happened is because God gave me the gifts and abilities and put me in a place to do it in the first place. So it's not about me at all. It's just about him and his blessing.
We'll leave you with one more of his three poems from the Poetry Out Loud competition in Juneau.
Famous by Naomi Shihab Nye.
I like that one too because it was talking about being famous, not for doing anything spectacular, but for doing something that that you were made to do.
The river is famous to the fish. The loud voice is famous to silence, which knew it would inherit the earth before anybody said so. The cat sleeping on a fence is famous to the birds watching him from the birdhouse. The idea you carry close to your bosom is famous to your bosom. The tear is famous, briefly, to the cheek. The boot is famous to the earth, which is more famous than the dress shoe, which is famous only to floors. The bent photograph is famous to the one who carries it, and not at all famous to the one who's pictured. I want to be famous to shuffling men who smile while crossing streets, sticky children in grocery lines, famous as the one who smiled back. I want to be famous in the way a pulley is famous, or a buttonhole, not because it did anything spectacular, but because it never forgot what it could do.
That was Sam Blom from Port Allsworth at the Poetry Out Loud competition in Juneau last spring. As many will recall, Blom lost his father and younger brother and sister in a tragic plane crash earlier this month. Listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG, and we're revisiting some stories we covered this past year. In a busy summer full of many wildlife stories, the one of two scientists watching helplessly as two whales died a slow death stood out more than the others. This first aired back in early July. The natural world around us here is wonderful and raw, and surely it's a privilege to be reminded of just how so once in a while. But two scientists posted at Cape Pierce on Bristol Bay's northwest coast this summer witnessed nature take its toll more than they may have wanted. Lisa Andriano and Mike Walgren are biologists with California State Parks and have spent the past 14 summers volunteering for seabird research in Alaska. Alone at Cape Pierce for 2 weeks, they watched helplessly as a stranded gray whale cow and calf died a slow, brutal death over 12 days. I spoke with Lisa Andriano by phone and asked her to relay the story, beginning with the morning they discovered the whales after a short hike from the cabin up a sandy dune that overlooks the mouth of the bay.
And we noticed something huge and out of place on the beach. And sure enough, when we got there, it was an adult gray whale that had beached out on a sandy shoal at Maggie Beach, probably came in on the high tide feeding. And we looked kind of around and we saw a calf that was way up the beach towards the inlet of the bay. So we went and checked the calf out, and they seemed to be breathing and moving their tails and moving their bodies and their mouths around. The baby was vocalizing, the mom wasn't. And we decided at that point that we would call Fish and Wildlife Service and find out what they wanted us to do.
Unfortunately, there was nothing that could be done. The Togiak Refuge contacted NOAA, which has jurisdiction over and often assets to help with stranded whales. But Cape Pierce is remote, and NOAA staff were busy with other dead whales elsewhere in the state. Andriano and Walgren were advised to try and keep the animals wet and cool and wait until the next high tide, which would hopefully float them off.
That's what we did. We went back and we got shovels and buckets and blankets and sheets, and we basically just continued to bucket them down with cold seawater, covered them with blankets, keeping those blankets wet to kind of protect their skin and just to keep them moist so they didn't overheat.
They also tried to dig around the whales, hoping to get them in a little more water or give them more wiggle room. That was day one, but the tides were getting smaller each day, which sealed the whales' fate. High water came up again, and the whales stayed beached.
We tried for multiple days during the high tide to push them, and there was just no getting these whales free. They were just too stuck, and there wasn't enough water. As I mentioned, the tides were going down. That went on for quite a few days until we realized that there was no way we were going to be able to get them out. And at that point, we were pretty much directed to just kind of let nature take its course.
The agonizing days ticked by. Gray whales migrate from the Baja Peninsula, where this calf was born last winter, up to the Bering or Chukchi Seas to feed in these shallow coastal waters for the summer. Death was coming for this pair, but not on Mercy's clock. Andriano and Walgren sat guard at night, chasing off predators, and helped cool the whales during the unseasonably hot days. For maybe the first week, Andriano says the animals were able to defend themselves against birds and foxes by wiggling and opening their mouths.
The mama was alive for about 10 days, and the baby was alive for about 12 days before she finally died. And they got worse over time. You know, their skin started to crack and peel, and the birds started to peck at them. And the more they deteriorated, the more other animals started taking advantage of them, which is all nature. It's all part of it, but it was hard to observe that and not be able to do anything to help them.
The scientists wrestled with two questions. First, should they put these whales out of their misery? Andriano says that was what they both desperately wanted to do. But federal law is strict and clear that these gray whales could not be killed. That is, unless Alaska Natives took them for subsistence. Nearby villages were contacted, but there was little interest in hazarding the journey to Cape Pierce to salvage the whales. The second question on their minds was, unable to kill the stranded, suffering animals, were their efforts to comfort and protect them perhaps the wrong thing to do?
Is it better for us to just let nature take its course and hopefully they'll die sooner than later? Are we just prolonging their misery by protecting their skin? I mean, these are conversations that we had, and we went round and around until we both felt like the best thing to do at a certain point was to just back off.
Had this location been nearer to town, a boat or bulldozer might have moved the whales off the beach. Had they been dolphins, Andriano and Walgren might have saved them. As it was, they realized they were witness to a scene that would be playing out whether they were there or not, and is probably repeated often along Alaska's 34,000 miles of shoreline. That was the rational thinking, but Andriano says the 12 days were an emotional and gut-wrenching experience. Like finding the carcasses of bull moose interlocked by their antlers, nature reminds us that some lives end badly.
It's beautiful and it's brutal, right? That's what nature is. There's so much beauty, and that place is so beautiful and it's so remote. And this is just part of the food chain out there, and you can have that conversation with yourself logically, but being a human wanting to help, it's very difficult.
On day 10, the mother finally died, and ironically, the tide that day climbed back high enough to float and carry away her carcass. The calf died 2 days later, just as the high waters began to reach its body as well. Andriano and Walgren boarded a plane that day, July 4th, back to Dillingham. They carried with them carefully documented notes on the slow decay of two stranded live gray whales, hoping something useful might come of it. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment. Something we'd wanted to take a closer look at for a while is what may be the biggest brown bear hunt in the world. Every other year, 600 to 700 hunters are drawn to the Alaska Peninsula, often spending upwards of $25,000 for a chance to bag a trophy grizz. While it was underway this spring, we sent Hannah Colton over to find out more.
On the bank of the Naknek River in King Salmon is Float Plane Row, where a hunter just flew in from the field. He's got a hide laid out on the gravel alongside a bloody bear skull. He's waiting for Dave Crowley and Chris Peterson. They're wildlife biologists from the local fish and game office, and they set up shop on the tailgate of their pickup truck.
This is a caliper and a ruler. I am measuring the length and the width of the skull. You add that together and you get skull size.
When hunters, like this guy from Anchorage, get back with their trophies, this is one of the first boxes they have to check. They have to get fish and game to seal the skull and the hide. It's a quick inspection to take some samples.
I'm just taking a hair sample for DNA.
And to make sure the hunter has crossed his T's and dotted his I's.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Congratulations. Great job.
Back in town, I stop in at the King Salmon Airport. Penn Air agent Lisa Davis tells me she's been checking bear hides for successful hunters all week. She had 6 yesterday, packed up in plastic bags or totes.
We have a lot of hunters that come in with bears, and you generally know because they do stink. Even if they're carefully prepared, when they come in, they smell very bad.
By now, she's used to the smell, but she says getting these on the plane doesn't always go smoothly.
Oh, yeah. We had a passenger come in last night whose baggage was overweight for his bear hide, and he had to lose 20 pounds, so he suggested that he take it outside, cut off the feet, so that it would be underweight so that he could get it on the plane last night. We went ahead and let him ship it as cargo so that he did not have to do that.
The noon flight has been canceled, as happens often and unexpectedly at the King Salmon Airport. And it's left one hunter sitting in the lobby, waiting for the next flight out.
My name's Wayne Hott. I'm a retired Air Force dentist. I live in Wichita, Kansas.
Wayne is a trim 68-year-old. He wears a crisp wool button-up and clean matching camos, and he's fiddling with his smartphone.
I think one of my family just replied back to the text with the picture of the bear.
Wayne Hott has been waiting years for this moment, when he gets to report that he's taken a brown bear. He says he's hunted lots of big game, but brown bears have been a touchy subject since he had 3 unsuccessful trips in Southeast Alaska over a decade ago.
And I did other things to try and forget about the brown bear, but obviously I couldn't forget about it completely.
According to rates listed on the AAA Alaskan Outfitters website, Wayne shelled out more than $24,000 for a 15-day guided trip on the Alaska Peninsula. His first week in the field, the weather was iffy. A few good hunting days and a couple rainy ones spent in the tent. Then his luck turned.
Must have been Monday. Yeah, Monday was day 8 of my hunt.
Wayne and his guide were in a pop-up blind when they spotted a sow with 2 cubs on the side of the mountain.
And all of a sudden there was this lot bigger bear above him and came down toward him, and the 2 bears were just nose to nose like a couple of dogs posturing at each other. And this was like a mile off, but we could see them.
Finally, the bigger bear left the others. It started moving down the mountain toward a grassy spot in the valley that looked promising.
We grabbed our packs and took off at 4 o'clock and shot the bear at 4:45. And we were back in camp, I think, either 7:30 or 8 o'clock with the bear skinned.
Leaving the rest of the carcass in the field for scavengers to find, Wayne was happy to get out of there. He'd had about enough of the rain and cramped tent. His 9-foot bear hide will continue its journey. It'll be cleaned, salted, and then FedExed back to Kansas, where Wayne's favorite taxidermist is on call. Eventually, the bear will be mounted with the rest of the Hott family collection. Wayne wants his bear on a grassy base in a natural position, so not fierce or growling, but he says with the teeth visible. He is a retired dentist, after all.
The thing that's so remarkable about the bear, though, is that I like the most in my wife, and it's important because she's always asking me where we're going to put the next one. She'll love this because it's beautiful. The legs are all from like the elbow down to its foot. It's dark brown, and then it's just varying shades of brown, light brown, blonde, and tan. Big, wide head. It's a beautiful, beautiful specimen.
Besides the looks, what Wayne loves about this bear is the fact that he shot it with ammunition he made himself. He says this is the fourth dangerous game he's taken with his own hand-loaded ammunition.
I can check the speed of the bullet so I know what its trajectory is and all that kind of stuff. It's just really getting into the weeds with that hobby, but that trips my trigger and I like it. I'm retired, so I've got the time to do it.
So it's like really the science, like almost the physics of it that you like.
It's the satisfaction of taking the components that go together to make a rifle cartridge and making it work, having it shoot accurately, and then having it perform well when it better perform well. You know, if you're trying to take a Cape Buffalo or a leopard or a brown bear, ammunition better work. Better work.
According to the regulations for this spring hunt, when you take a brown bear, that's it. You can't get another one for 4 years. But that doesn't bother Wayne Hott a bit. He did what he came to do. Reporting in King Salmon, I'm Hannah Colton.
As we wrap up this show, we'll end with a portion of a unique story we had the chance to be a part of telling, even as we stayed out of the way. Interviews we had aired with Terry Rogers of Dillingham talking about the murder of former DPD officer Tony Jones had caught the attention of Tony's daughter Antoinette Fields, who lives in Maryland. She was not at Dillingham the night he was killed back in February of 1992. Fields found our stories with Terry Rogers online and reached out to ask us about Terry's involvement and why he was advocating for parole for Tony's killer, Eugene Maude. We put Terry Rogers and Antoinette Fields in touch for the first time by phone, and they let us listen in. In this portion of the interview, just past the small talk, she seeks information for long unanswered questions.
Did he talk about me?
He did. He talked about you quite often.
It's hard to believe that it's been 25 years.
It's coming 25. It's been 24 in, 4 months?
Unfortunately, yes. I actually know how many years and how many months. And they say it gets easier with time, but I haven't found that yet.
Do you have any specific questions for me or anything, any direction you want to take this at this point?
I have one question, and you don't have to go into detail. But this is just what I've heard over the years, and I don't want to jump into that night completely, but it's going to sound funny, I know, but I hate the snow. And I tell you why. Did they let him lay in that snow for a long time that night?
They did not, and I don't think there was much snow on. We actually had rescue squad members that went and got him fairly early on, and I can tell you the temperature was 6 degrees above zero, and there was what they call ice fog in the air, so it wasn't windy or anything, and it was next to a building, so it was protected from the wind, and he did not lay there long.
Did he suffer?
Tony, I'm going to tell you he did not, and I'm going to tell you the position he was in. I firmly believe, and I've said before and I'll say again, he was instantly lights out and collapsed, not knowing what had happened to him.
You know, if it makes any sense, that makes me feel better. Even though I'm crying like a baby, after almost 25 years, I actually feel better about that one fact. Can I ask something else?
Sure.
Did he mean to kill my daddy? I mean, did my daddy do something wrong to him? Did
no.
He arrest him for something or
no.
Anything?
Your father never arrested him, to my knowledge. Just a troubled young 17-year-old man. And whether he intended to kill your father or not, I don't know.
Terry Rogers told Antoinette Fields about his visit to the parole board hearing where he had the chance to ask for Maude's early release. That was something that had shocked her initially to hear, but Rogers explained that the once young man, in his view, was now a repentant adult who had broken down in tears when Rogers told the board that he forgave him. Before Rogers and Fields said goodbye, she said that the last conversation she remembered having with her dad had ended on a sour note, something she'd had a hard time letting go of all these years.
He would always say, "I love you, daughter," and I'd tell him, "I love you too, Dad." And this particular conversation, he didn't. And I beat myself up for 24 years of, God, I wish I hadn't done whatever it was that I had done that caused him to fuss at me. I really wanted to call him back that night just to tell him, hey, I love you. And I didn't. And then a couple days later, he was gone. And I always wondered if Mr. Mould was sorry. Because, believe it or not, I feel like knowing that he was sorry would make it just a tad bit easier for me to, you know, understand that he went through things and, you know, apparently it got the best of him. My heart hurts for him because, I mean, yes, he took my dad away from me, and no harm before I started corresponding with you. Like I say, I was built with a lot of rage and a lot of anger towards that man. A man I've never met a day in my life. A man that if he walked in my house right now, I would have no clue who he was.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
No clue. But at the same token, with the way I was raised, there's more than one side to a story. And I can't say that if I went through what he went through, I'd be any different. Talking to you makes it, I want to say, hard to harbor ill will towards him anymore.
Yeah. I think there's got to be some good in some of this somewhere.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, me too, hon.
You know, believe it or not, I feel a little bit better about this already.
That was Antoinette Fields, the daughter of the late DPD officer Tony Jones, speaking with former DPD officer Terry Rogers in an interview we aired last June. You can find that in its entirety and most of the rest of the stories we aired this year at our website, kdlg.org. That's it for our look back, our Bristol Bay and Beyond, in case you missed it, 2016. We had quite a few talented musicians join us this year, but we're out of time to sample them all. But Jonathan Maracle and Bill Pagaran from Broken Walls were in our studio almost a year ago, and we'll let them take us out.